Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We are in the book of Numbers. The section is Matot and Matzei, which is means tribes and journeys. This is a double portion. So this is blended together. We're going through Numbers study all the way through the end of the book of Numbers. Any questions or comments? Anne? Correct. Once the high priest dies, you didn't say that correctly. In the case of, this is unintentional murders, these are not murderers who did it intentionally, these are for accidental, unintentional murders. When someone dies, when someone murders somebody unintentionally, they must flee the city, they have to await trial in the city, the hearings verify, they find out if it was intentional or not, that's what the trial is for. And they found it was not intentional, it was an unintentional death, unintentional murder, then the person is returned to the city of refuge they had fled to. They must live there in the city until the high priest dies, a natural death preferably. And then they can then go back from that city to their own personal residence of house, their own home wherever they came from originally. Does that make sense? So, and it also says that person, the individual, cannot pay money in order to get off out of the city of refuge to go home early. That's not allowed. They have to stay there until the high priest dies. There's not an option there. If they don't, they are subject to the avenger of death killing them. And there'd be no blood guilt. It's not considered a murder. You can't kill the murderer that in that instance. It's not considered a murder in that case. Does that make sense? What was that, dear?
Wizard of Oz.
Kind of. That's how the murderer... Now, if it's an intentional murder during the trial time, when a trial takes place... The one who is intentionally murderer, he's the one who is executed on the spot or at that time. And does not delay, they don't go back to the city of refuge for a period of time. Any other questions or comments regarding this? Yes, Buran. Oaths and vows, yes. That's a very good point, good question. So she's asking, why were people making oaths or vows? See my marker here. Oaths and vows are two separate things. In our culture, we tend to blend them together as one. They're not. Oaths is one thing. A vow is completely different. So they're defined differently. So, for example, we tested this last time. Last year, we covered this. A vow, which is known as a neder in Hebrew, but a vow is a prohibition. Prohibit. For either yourself or your family regarding something that is permitted. So prohibit regarding, R-E-G, something that is permitted. So for example, I can say, I am vowing not to eat chicken for a month. That is a vow. Chicken is permitted, I'm allowed to eat it, by making a vow that I will not do so. Make sense? So as opposed to, I say, I make a vow not to eat pork. Wait, pork's not permitted anyway. That's not a vow, it's an invalid vow, it's meaningless. I'm just saying, I'm not going to fly with like a bird anymore. It's the same thing, you can't do it anyway, so it doesn't matter. So a vow is prohibit against something regarding something that is permitted. It is also, you can obligate something regarding something that is optional. So, for example, I may say, I'm going to walk to work for a month. Now, yeah, good luck. I might be a little exhausted there. That I'm obligating myself an optional thing. I don't have to walk. but I'm choosing to walk. I can choose not to, but it's an optional decision. See, as opposed to I'm not prohibiting an object, something that's permitted. I'm doing an action. I'm an action of walking. So the obligation is regarding actions that are optional things to do. Also, prohibition is regarding something that is permitted to do. These are vows. Oaths are different. I apologize. Let me redefine this. I misspoke that. I read my wrong sentence. Require. So oath requires. Too many R's there. An oath requires or prohibits performing of an action. You can write or prohibit an action. I'll pray for you. That's an oath. Right? I pray for you. That's an oath. These are different things. They're not the same thing. It's defined as an action. Why does someone do this? Do you have to do it? No. You cannot make a vow. You cannot make an oath. There's no requirement to make one. If you do, there are requirements regarding you've bound yourself regarding the rules of oaths and vows. Does that make sense? And what are the rules regarding oaths and vows? Well, it says here, if I'm male, I'm bound by them. There's no way around. I can't undo it. If I'm a female, it depends on my condition. If I'm divorced, I'm bound by them. If I'm widowed, I'm bound by them. If I'm a young person, a young girl in my father's house, my father may choose to unbind me or may choose to bind me. That's his decision. Otherwise, I'm bound by them. Or if I'm my husband's house, my husband may choose to bind me or unbind me with my own voices, my own actions. So if you're female, you have methodologies of getting out, but not necessarily are taken or doesn't always work that way. Your dad may say, yeah, you did it. That's your problem. You're going to live. You made your bed. You're going to live in it. But the reason why women have those ways out is because she may say, I'm going to marry so-and-so. And the father says, no, you're not. She may have vowed she's going to marry him. He finds out, said, no, you're not marrying that man. So he can overrule her. That allows that's the source or the main story behind how she's able to get out of these vows. Because but he's so cute. He has whatever. What a girl's like. All these reasons why she loves him. And father would say, you're not going to marry this man. It's not going to happen. I won't permit it. You're not. I'm taking away this option. Now, that's not to say she can't sneak out the bedroom at night and go down to local church and get knocked up. Get married and knocked up later. That's all the story. But the point is, what she actually does is between her and God. But her father would say, hey, I'm stopping your vows. You cannot agree to do this. I've changed. You can't do this. She may then rebel and do it anyway, but that's a different story. Then she's in her own father, her own husband's household at that point. Yes. Trying? Like a warning. No, I won't go there. Excuse me. Men make decisions too, regarding emotions. The difference is we get held to them. And the feet to the fire kind of thing. Basic ideas of vows. Now, you, as it commands here, there's no law saying you have to have a vow. Let's see, what's verse? What verse was that? Is it prohibited? He will not stand. Oh, maybe the Torah section. Some one of these verses has you don't. There's no. There's, oh, it's in Book of Deuteronomy. Yeah, Book of Deuteronomy. We'll go there shortly. As far as reading the details, Book of Deuteronomy 20, chapter 23 adds more details regarding vows and it specifies clearly there you don't have to make one, but if you do, you must follow these rules. We'll go to 23 in a minute. Regarding certain laws, this shouldn't affect most of you, but you should be aware of how they work. In Jewish law, This is not biblical law. This is Jewish law. They're different. A vow can be absolved by a panel of three judges. They can absolve a vow. That is not according to the Torah's instruction. It's a father or a husband has to absolve a vow, not a panel of three judges. I don't know why, when they came to the panel of three judges, but that's what they did. I'm not trying to paint him in a bad light because I respect the man for many things he did. Rabbi Akiva added an additional way out regarding vows. He said, well, if you didn't understand all the details behind the ramifications of your vow, meaning the possibilities that what you vowed and why you vowed it would change the future, then you are not obligated to the vow. And he did that for his father-in-law, who made a mistake, and it financially benefited Akiva afterward, but that's a different story. I'm not saying he did it for money. The point is, he just made a decree. And so what happens in that instance is he argued that because you didn't know, you thought this was the circumstance, whatever it was, and you were deceived, or you didn't understand what you were actually talking about, and you made a vow against it, you should not be held liable for it. That was his argument. That's something he created. I'm not saying he's right or wrong. This is what he created. The Torah explicitly states, the Book of Judges and Book of Joshua and Ecclesiastes and Deuteronomy say the exact opposite. They say, no, you are bound. This is a binding thing. You can't get out of it. Even if you were deceived, you cannot get out of it. The deception, you could be deceived. Someone can lie to you and you could be in the vow and you made a vow. You're bound by it. We read that. Actually, let's read that and let's discuss what that means. Let's jump to the book of Judges and jump to Book of Joshua chapter 9. We'll discuss how important this thing is and that the people of Israel, this is their understanding at this time when Moses is making these decrees of what vows mean and how they are important to be held. So Joshua chapter 9, we're going to read part of the story so you have a better understanding on what this happened and how vows are viewed. Afterward, we'll go to Ecclesiastes and see how that is also viewed as well. Joshua chapter 9. It came to pass when all the kings who were on this side of Jordan in the hills and the lowlands and all the coasts of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite heard of it. They gathered together to fight with Joshua and Israel with one accord. But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they worked craftily and went and pretended to be ambassadors, and they took old sacks on their donkeys, old wineskins and mended them, old patched sandals on their feet, and old garments on themselves. And all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy. And they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal and said to him and the men of Israel, we have come from a far country. Now therefore, make a covenant with us. But the men of Israel said to the Hivites, perhaps you will dwell among us. So how can we make a covenant with you? This is to Joshua, we are your servants. And Joshua said to them, who are you and where do you come from? So they said to him, from a very far country, your servants have come because of the name of Jehovah your God, for we have heard of his name and all that he did in Egypt. And all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, who was at Ashtaroth. Therefore our elders and all of the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, take provisions with you for the journey, and go to meet them and say to them, we are your servants. Now therefore make a covenant with us. This bread of ours we took hot for our provision from our houses on the day we departed to come to you. But now look, it is dry and moldy. And these wineskins which we filled were new, and see, they are torn. And these our garments and our sandals have become old because of the very long journey. Then the men of Israel took some of the provisions, but they did not ask the counsel of Jehovah. So Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the rulers of the congregation swore to them. And it happened at the end of 3 days, after they had made a covenant with them, that they heard that they were their neighbors who dwelt near them. So Israel journeyed and camped, came to their cities on the third day. Now the cities were Gibeon, Hefriha, at Beeroth and Kirjath-Jearim. But the children of Israel did not attack them, because the rulers of the congregation had sworn to them by Jehovah God of Israel, and all the congregation murmured against the rulers. Then all the rulers said to all the congregation, "We have sworn to them by Jehovah God of Israel, now therefore we may not touch them. This we will do to them, we will let them live, lest wrath be upon us because of the oath which we swore to them." And the rulers said to them, "Let them live, but let them be woodcutters and water carriers for all the congregation, as the rulers had promised them." Then Joshua called for them, and he spoke to them, saying, "Why have you deceived us, saying, 'We are very far from you,' when you dwell near us? Now therefore you are cursed, and none of you shall be freed from being slaves, woodcutters and water carriers for the house of my God." So they answered Joshua and said, "Because it was certainly told to your servants that Jehovah your God commanded his servants to Moses to give to you all the land, and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Therefore we are very much afraid of our lives because of you, and have done this thing. And now here we are in your hands. Do with us as seems good and right to you, to us." So he did to them and delivered them out of the hand of the children of Israel, so that they did not kill them. And that day Joshua made them woodcutters and water carriers for the congregation and for the altar of Jehovah and the place which he would choose, even to this day. Yes.
So when they vowed,
yes, when they vowed or gave an oath, he's asking if they used God's name or Jehovah's name, his identity. Well, in this instance, because God is really big about not destroying his name. You can use it, but use it properly. Don't destroy it. So you use a vow or oath, and you've made in his name, God is my witness, I will never do X, Y, Z again. Or such and such I saw is actually true. You're swearing by God's name when you do that.
You didn't bring that out.
No, sorry. Nadir and oaths, that's a given. I apologize. I should be more specific. When you're making a vow or making an oath, these are assumed you're invoking or talking as God as your witness. You're identifying as God as a witness. God is a witness against you or for you. We have the same principle. We have vows for like wedding vows. Usually there's a preacher, there's prayers there. You're invoking God as a witness that these vows are legit and being held. They cited God's name. Now in Joshua's example, chapter 9 we just read, could he get out of it? No. Was he deceived? Absolutely. Deception doesn't matter. Deception isn't part of the vow. Just because you were deceived and getting into it doesn't mean it gets you out of it. That's not how God works. Don. Young men under your roof. You are considered fully responsible until you reach the age of 20 years and up. If you're a 19-year-old male and you make a vow, it doesn't matter because it doesn't count. you're not an adult yet. You're still a child. It's different than a 4-year-old or one-year-old making some comment, "I'll love you forever, Daddy." Well, forever is until you die, because you really can't go beyond that, right? you know, there's a limitation, but they're a child, so making these things, so it wouldn't work. Women, it doesn't matter their age if they're in their father's house. They'd be over 20. If they're still in the father's house, the father still dominates. That's different rules. Yes, Tammy.
I think one way we can think of this issue is
financial dependence.
Meaning, what I mean by that, for a man, once you are out of your father's house at 19, 20 years old, whatever that is, you're no longer financially dependent on your father. So you, if you make a vow or an oath, and it goes south, you own it.
You own it.
But for women in this culture, at least, when they're young girls, they're under the authority of their father. So if they make a vow or an oath, and there's involving money, this is money that actually
it's
is.
A dad's money.
And
yeah.
She's financially dependent on her husband.
Her husband pays for the vows if there's something wrong.
He's actually going to pay for the vows. Yeah. So obviously then he would have a right to have a word to say about it. But a divorcee, a widow, she is financially responsible for herself. So she doesn't have that out to
the responsibility payment. So what Tammy just pointed out, that there's an element, a potential element of financial burden. When you make a vow, you may have a penalty pay for the vow. So for example, "I will do this, else I'll pay that," type of thing. Well, and who pays for it? If you're in your father's household, Your father's paying for it. It's his household, his wealth. He covers your errors or your vows. When you're outside the father's household, whoever up there, that you're either you're on your own, or a divorcee, or a widow, you pay your own financial burden for your vows, your mistakes. If you're a young child, you're not. But if you're a male, 20 years up, you're booted out of the house, you know, go get a job, enjoy yourself, and you pay for your own vows. So it could be an element of responsibility that comes from the dad who, or the father's house who pays for it. Pierre, you had your hand up a minute ago?
Oh, I just wanted to comment that in Joshua's case, he was deceived.
Right. Yes. It was. I won't say that it was a self-willed deceive. He was like more negligently deceived. But still, you're right. There could be a way out of it. If he had sought God ahead of time, he would not have had this problem. But because he failed on his due diligence on finding out the truth, it's his own responsibility. Much like us, our own. We can be deceived. And we can be willingly deceived or not willingly deceived. If we don't do our due diligence of investigating, are we being deceived? Who's responsible? Who's at fault for making the foolish vow? We are. We willingly did not do our due diligence to find out if something's true or not on making a vow. Like, for example, you marry somebody who has 5 wives already. Well, you didn't inquire. You're not number 6. You should have asked ahead of time or done a due diligence of inquiry first instead of finding out you're in a polygamous relationship by accident. Let's see here. There's more examples of vows. I won't go through all of them because we can break. We can take a break, actually, right now. I've got some of these vows real quick, though. We'll go to Judges. There's a couple of vows there. And then we'll go to a few of the details later on. So I probably won't have time to read all these details of the vows, but Judges 21, you have the vows that the children of Benjamin. You recall that Benjamin, the tribe Benjamin, gets hacked away and killed off by all the tribes except 600 men. But all the people who were part of the battle had vowed they would not give wives, daughters to these men. But they made the vow. They couldn't break the vow. They couldn't say, well, they're going to die off anyway. Let's go ahead and give them a wife anyway. Take my daughter. They couldn't do that. They made vows. They had to not do it. So the only way they got around it, they got around by a kidnapping and, well, murder. They killed the residents of Gilead, I think it was. They killed all the people there, captured 400 young women, and gave them to the people of Benjamin, because those people did not make the vow. They weren't originally part of the Benjamin battling. So they considered these women part of captives. And then they wouldn't have enough, so they convinced 200 other families to have their young ladies go out there and dance and have a good party, and then had the Benjamin, the 200 men who were still needing wives, come and kidnap them. So the vow was more important than the fact that they were murdering and kidnapping people. It was better to murder and kidnap than it is to break the vow. You know, it seems odd to us. That's crazy. Why would you ever do that? Well, because they invoked God's name, and God doesn't take his name lightly. So if you make a vow and you invoke God's name, he's going to hold you to it. And they thought it better a few die than a few kidnapped.
The proportion had to do with the cities and sections and areas, the travelings of Israel, the journeyings, as it goes by, say, means to journey.
Because we all...
The reason I'm not going to go through all the names again.
I read off last time. Shouldn't have made.
I butchered most of them, so forgive me, but that's chapter 33 and 34 for the most part. I have a lot of different territories which they're bound by. I want to bring a few things to your attention, though, regarding the second section with the journeyings. The
chapter 33 of Numbers, where the second Torah portion begins, around those various different places they went to. They did go, obviously, to... It starts out, obviously, from Egypt all the way through.
I won't go into the details of each place they went. But they left, of course, the 15th day of the first month, right after the Passover. That term shows up again in Joshua regarding the timing of when they had their first food of the new territory after they crossed the Jordan River. They also had their first taste of the produce of the land at that time, the day after the Passover, on the 15th day of the month.
of the first month. And we have a beginning and end time, so to speak. So when they come out of Egypt, the 15th day of the first month, they leave Ramses. And then on the 15th day of the first month, the manna stops. 40 years later, essentially. Although the manna didn't start immediately when they left Ramses. The point is that they ate manna for 40 years. And when the 15th day of the first month shows up after they cross the Jordan River in Joshua chapter 5, verse 11, points out that once they ate the produce of the land, the manna then ends. Now they're wholly in eating what grows from the ground. And that's when God had ended his time of provision for them. So it's a good starting point, 15th of the first month, and ending point, 15th of the first month. Now you're on your own, so to speak. You're between you and the land and try to work out your provisions. The way I bring your attention to, however, is when they inherit the land, the tail end of chapter 33, it discusses obvious, which we've already know this very well generally, but verse 55 of Numbers 33. If you do not drive out the inhabitants of them before you, those of them whom you leave shall be pins in your eyes and a surrounding barrier of thorns in your sides. They will harass you upon the land in which you dwell. It shall be that what I meant to do to them, I shall do to you. What does that warning mean? Does it mean I have to kill everybody off? Did I kill everybody? Yeah? So, in this territory, which you have this map up here, they're crossing the Red Sea right about here, by the way. The north half of the Dead Sea before they cross it. This is the location on this map where they're crossing, where they're about to cross. And they're hanging out in this general area. So they're going to cross the sea. But whatever I meant to do to them, referring to all people of this territory, I will do to you. What does that mean to you as a recipient of that warning? What was that?
You'll die.
If you don't get rid of them, what God meant to do to them, he'll do to you, he'll do to me. If I don't get rid of them, this thorn in my side and this pin in my eye, God will treat me like I'm one of them. Does that make sense? You will become one of them. One of the same people who he's trying to get rid of. He says, what I meant to do to them, I will do to you. So if we don't pay attention to this, as a general rule, so our job is to remove the Canaanites, which is the Hittites and all the various ites that you can rattle off to. So the Canaanites in general. If we don't remove Canaan, we'll become Canaan. Not necessarily in every detail the Canaanites do, but if the punishment is the same, we might as well have been them. It makes no difference. So if you don't remove Canaan, you become Canaan. So you have to do this route, else you'll become it. It's a warning in general, which we already know by Proverbs and various other comments. Good does not corrupt evil. It doesn't. Evil corrupts good. And the good doesn't become, you know, a little bit worse. No. Good becomes corrupt, it's twisted, and it becomes what is evil. It will transition into that process. If we don't pay attention to what we're doing and what the focus is, we become our own enemy. Have you become your own enemy before? I have. I've been some of my own worst enemies. You've heard of it. And sometimes it's yourself. And the thing you're trying to avoid, you end up becoming it.
Yes.
Then you try to attack and get rid of, you end up becoming that thing in the process of trying to attack and get rid of it. So watch what you're doing, watch what we do. When we remove the sin, transgressions, iniquity, all those various evil things in our inclination, if we don't remove them, those same things we're trying to avoid will become them. We will convert ourselves into being what we're trying to avoid and abhor and hate. And that's his warning here. What if it in lost verse 56? It should be that what I meant to them, I will do to you. You will be the recipient of the land vomiting you out. It's a warning just to not for each not for individual human being to say, but for people as a whole. Be very patient and transparent in what you're looking at. What am I trying to get rid of? And stay focused on it, else you will become it. Yes, Carrie. Right. The scripture, everything is pure and just. The focus on these items. That's your objective. That's your goal. Else you, yeah. The other things that are not of those things, you must avoid. Okay. Now our little map here rattles off different boundaries and such. The Canaanites. The inheritance with the southern border and all the various details of the Mount Hor. Now, these maps which we have up here, and there's dozens of maps people make, and they all have different lines. Reality is, a little over half of the cities listed here, we have absolutely no clue where they're at. No clue. Not even a guess. Not even a, it's probably, no, actually, zero information. Zip, nothing. No, nothing at all. And so what historians, what do they literally don't even bother digging up the dirt. They guess, well, it's probably around here. And they put a little big blotted dot. So guess what nearest piece of rock on the ground. That was it. It's truly, truly a guess on mostly cities. Because as you know, all this stuff, there's some of these major dots here, major cities, we know who they are because they're still around. They still exist. But the cities listed here, like 40, 50 some odd cities listed in the place they went to, no one knows where they're at. No one's allowed to view half the area because in the journeyings they went through, that was most, a lot of that was in the Arabian territory, the Arabian Peninsula. No one's allowed to go in there because Saudi Arabia owns it. So you can't even see it. But most of these, no one knows where they're at. They have no idea where they went. They don't know what their names are today. But there's just a few they still have. Yes?
So I guess it's a correction that you must make to your...
A correction?
Yes. The Arabians might know.
The Arabians might know where some of them are. That's possible. But most of these cities, as far as Western culture, does not know where they're at. We're not allowed to find them. The Arabians renamed a lot of them, too. That's true. They're different titles, different names. So I won't go through all the different maps. This is just one randomized example. The reason I brought this example up was because the Manasseh territory, as you see, is relatively large compared to various other territories, the half-tribe of Manasseh. No one really knows it was this big or one-tenth that size because no one knows who the cities are. There's multiple cities with the same name, or even multiple mountains. The fact that Aaron died on Mount Hor, but the northern border of Israel is Mount Hor. They weren't in northern Israel. They're way down here below the South Dead Sea. So they're same name, place names, same mountain names, even landmarks, that are multiple different places. And so no one knows who they are or where they're at. In some places where people will, I built this city, it got destroyed, I came over here 30 miles away, built another one, came into the same city. But which one was which, what time, all that's lost to history. So we don't know a lot of details. What I want to bring out to you in these details, however, is Manasseh's territory, as you recall, when they came to Moses and asked him, it was Reuben and Gad specifically who came to Moses and asked about, they want their inheritance on the eastern side of the Jordan River, not on the western side. And of course, to go through the process, we'll discuss this in more detail in a few minutes. Manasseh gets included in this process, or half of Manasseh does, gets included in this process as well. The sons of Machir wind up going up here and taking out parts of the northern section of Manasseh. And they include one Jewish man, which is funny, because he's from the tribe of Judah, as also a section which they will inherit or take over. It is, let's see, where is it? All right, so it's the tale in verse 32, chapter 32 still. Jair, I think, is his name. He's actually from the tribe of Judah, not the tribe of Manasseh, though it lists here as a descendant of Manasseh, because his grandma was Manasseh, but his dad was from the tribe of Judah. It's minor details there, but intertribal marriage is pretty common. But the inheritance that he was inheriting, even though he's biologically from the tribe of Judah down here, his inheritance, he threw his hat in with Manasseh's tribe. Which you find that might find that strange why a man can do that, but a man can choose to switch tribes. In this example, we have one that did. Because on his mom's side, she is from Manasseh, and his dad is from Judah. Normally he'd be from Judah, that was his inheritance tribe. But he himself chose to join Manasseh's tribe. So he chose to say, my inheritance will be with Manasseh instead, by his decision. I bring that up because that's not uncommon. Gentiles, which most of us are, we don't have an inheritance with Israel. Big fat zero, not a nothing. How do you get an inheritance? You grab yourself in. How do you grab yourself in? There's a couple of ways. Taking hold of a tzitzit, which means I am attaching myself to you. That is a vow. When you're, or an oath, when you are saying, I'm going to follow this tribe or this culture, this group, I am taking, actually in this case being an oath, I'm making an oath. I'm going to do this. And what's God say? I'm holding you to it. I'm holding you to it. So when you attach yourself to something, you're being held to it. And Jair, in his case, he attached himself to Manasseh. And what did God do? Okay, your inheritance now is with Manasseh, not with Judah. So you are a Manasseh now. He chose to switch tribes in that respect, which is fine. Apparently it's not an issue. God didn't complain. But that's fine. So how do we get Caleb? Who was Caleb? Remember who Caleb was, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite? Well, that's not a biological descendant of the tribes of Judah. Now, that is a... what was that? Any of it. No, yeah, none of the tribes. He is truly Gentile. But yet, he is the leader of the tribe of Judah. How'd that happen? Well, it's one of the two that stuck with it. But so, his dad, Jephunneh, the Kenizzite from Kenaz, was his ancestral descendants listed in, I think it's Genesis like 15 or something like that. I can't remember the exact chapter. Somewhere in that range. It rattles off all of these different tribes, and it's identifies who he is. But he is attached, becomes leader of, and a whole follower of the tribe of Judah, and winds up leading it for at least a period of time of his life. He winds up leading it. So this is an important example we have. Someone who is not biologically Israelite, not biologically any tribe at all, but attached himself to. Now, we don't know at what point was he attached. Meaning, did his dad marry a woman from the tribe of Judah and become attached part? Was he then, is his mom Jewish or from a Jewish tribe? We have no knowledge of that record. But he himself attached himself to, and as a result, got a really important inheritance through that attachment. Yes?
It's kind of a picture of Messiah, because through Messiah,
yes, who are Messiah, we grafted in.
The sages teach that it was at Sinai, at the making, the giving of
the Ten Commandments, we get Sinai. The riffraff, the extra people who came out, yes.
They were grafted into Judah at that point.
It could be. I do realize that the rabbis are Judah-centric, so I don't know. They are still biased to the tribe of Judah too. I'm not sure. It's possible that's the point which Caleb became grafted. I do not know. But either way, he became grafted, became an important person at that time. Now, granted, he was about 40 years old or so, if I recall correctly. Joshua covers him and says he's 40 years old when he spies out the land. And then he finally gets it 45 years later. He's 85 years old before he actually has his own territory now. A long time, very diligent man to be very patient and wait that long. But that's what it shows you what kind of person it took to attach themselves. I'm making my vow or my oath. I am going to require this, my action upon this is who I now am. So we have within tribes, someone can do it. And somebody outside a tribe can do it. If you attach yourself, you are now attached. And Caleb, of course, invokes God's name a couple of times. He's using God as an identifier, as a witness. I am attaching myself to this tribe. And as a result, He was raised up, lifted up in that tribe as being one of the few that actually followed God. A very honorable man. Yes, Carrie. Ruth, yes, Ruth is another example as well. She marries into it. But before she married, well, not before, after she was a widow. But at that point, because she's a widow, she is now, all her oaths are hers, not her husband, not her dad. It's all, and she chose, I am choosing to follow Naomi in this case, and we attach herself to that tribe. Her sister-in-law, of course, did not. So we have examples of people saying, because I'm making my oath, I'm going to attach myself. And then we see they get blessed as a result. It's an important thing to remember. The reason I say that, why it's important to remember, I go to Isaiah chapter 56. Isaiah 56, the earlier section of that chapter, has a statement in here. Let's see here. It says, Isaiah chapter 56, this is in, where is it? The first three verses, all right? So start at verse 1 through verse 3 of Isaiah 56. Thus says Jehovah, keep justice and do righteousness, for my salvation is about to come. My righteousness is to be revealed. Blessed is the man who does this, and the son of the man who lays hold on it, who keeps from defiling the Shabbat and keeps his hand from doing any evil. Do not let the son of the foreigner who has joined himself to Jehovah speak, saying, Jehovah has utterly separated me from his people. Nor let the eunuch say, here I am, a dry tree. For just says the Lord, the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths and choose what pleases me and hold fast my covenant, even to them I will give in my house and within my walls a place and a name, better than that of the sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. That gives us God's promise through Isaiah speaking it, but Isaiah's quoting him, that God's saying, you attach yourself, I will make you great. I will make a place in my kingdom for you, a place in my house for you. And may they not say, I am separated. May they not be felt or treated independently. Now I bring this up. Some of you may have experienced this yourselves. I don't know. Have you ever been to a synagogue and they knew you were Gentile? What happens? You ever get that? The, oh. Have you experienced that? The, oh, they step away. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter the fact you're there to learn about God and say, hey, I'm attaching myself to... No, it's the step back. Now, I'm not criticizing... The synagogues. There's reasons. Now, if those of us who don't know the history of Judaism and how it got where it is, if they didn't do that, well, they wouldn't exist anymore. Because for 2,000 years, they've had continuous mass slaughters against the Jews. So I understand the stepping back. But the point is, in God's viewpoint, that's not the right solution. That isn't the best solution. What's the best solution? Don't treat the person as separate from you when they are coming to you. Say, I want to learn and join. I want to attach and find out about your God. Bring them in and invite them in to find out and teach about their God. That's what God's example here we have in Isaiah. That's the promise God's going to do. I'm not saying he's going to do it for every human being and every situation. Understand that. This is in God's hands. But the idea, that is the concept behind these people. We have two people. Go ahead, Larry, go first.
They can't prove that they're Jewish either.
Oh, but biologically, no one really prove it unless you have a trail that goes all the way back to... they do it by DNA guessing or the categorization. Even then, they just guess.
The DNA is real new.
It's a bit fuzzy. I'm not an expert on DNA and how it all works, so I really can't speak to how they try to prove things. But I won't go there. You can't prove a lot of things. It's how we treat each other that we focus the attention on. How is it treated?
So they're doing something against what Jehovah wanted in the first place.
In that instance, right.
You're in.
Right. Once you've attached, you're attached.
But they're also assuming that they're in, and they may not be.
Right. Right. And Christianity does a similar effect. If you go to, if a Jewish person comes to a Christian example and say, well, I still don't believe in Jesus, but I want to learn about what you can also receive the same, wait a minute. It can happen too. Both parties can do that. Not they should, but both parties could. Yes?
Well, and that's why God said, Lord, I'm going to raise up a people that
you don't
know.
Yes, that you don't know.
He's going to use them
them to make you jealous.
Right.
That's what the purpose and God's vision is for us Gentile believers, is to love
exactly.
the Jews.
Yep. Attach yourself. Yep. Yep.
And cause them to see that, okay, this Jesus that they
think is bad. Yep. Yep.
Kidnapped, redressed,
Greek clothing and repackaged as a new thing. Yes, and that's part of that's probably the primary separation. I realize that the Gentile means you're Christian. They kind of step back because that's that association. And I do realize there's tons and tons of baggage that comes with that. As a Christian, the Christian side, you have baggage that you don't even know about. Truly. The baggage that you do know about, oh, you've been taught about Christmas and Easter, all that stuff. That's the baggage you know about. You don't know about the baggage that happened before you were even born. The murders, the pogroms, the stuff that is your heritage also. You say, well, I wasn't there. It doesn't matter. What you came from was. It's the baggage that's still there. It's really, really, really hard when you think you have two bags talking to somebody, and they look behind you, you have 5,000 bags behind you that you're not looking at, but they see because they know your history. Not your personal history, the history of the people you come from. It's really hard to have a conversation when all they see is this massive train of baggage. It's really hard. So on both sides, there needs to be a little bit of grace and forgiveness. A little bit. Okay, I'm not trying to criticize anyone. The point is, or in any particular group. The point is that this is a human nature. We keep what we think is our baggage, not realizing we have a lot more of it that we don't necessarily see. And others might see it, and we may never see it. But all those issues are part of these problems. What Isaiah is pointing out, the book of Isaiah is pointing out, is that this will end. No more, you will not say you're separate. You will be attached. The baggage will finally go off on the train station to the next best train stop. You won't be going with it.
On that day.
That's the goal. But that just give you perspective on some of these details. So let's move forward a little bit. Murders and unintentional murders of chapter 35. We talked briefly earlier about last time, the previous section before break, regarding how you get out of this murderous situation as far as your accident or unintentional murders and things like that. And you have to stay there, of course, until the high priest eventually dies. So, and there's no question about that. We're at chapter 36, the tail end of the section. So chapter 36 is the inheritance section. So you have, in this sense, chapter 36, we have a family from Manasseh. Now I'm not sure which section of Manasseh, the eastern side, the western side. From Zelophehad. Now if we recall correctly, the previous Torah, or two Torah portions ago, the five daughters of Zelophehad came and said, hey, our father died in his sins in the wilderness. Now, you cannot overstress that statement. That means those five daughters knew their father was a corrupt individual and deserved to die in the wilderness. That's what they're admitting. He died in his sins. Because what was that? Their father was part of the original parents who came out of Egypt and had rebelled against the 12 spies, well, to 10 spies, because there were 12 total, but two didn't. 10 spies joined with them and said, hey, we're not going, it's too awful, the giants were like grasshoppers. I can't imagine that, but that's what they said. He's part of that group. And his five daughters recognize, yeah, he's dead, and we're not criticizing or upset that God killed him because he deserved it. We're agreeing with this. But our inheritance, he had no sons. So our inheritance has to go to us, right? And of course, that was a deal. Now Manasseh's pointing out, wait a minute, they could marry somebody from Reuben or Gad or anybody else. Of course, now the transfers to the tribe. I want to point this out to us because this is the only section that I can think of. Now, you might think of more. This is one that I know about. Hopefully there are more. Where Orthodox Judaism is more liberal than Reform. This is probably the only thing. Where did my eraser go? I lost my eraser. Oh, here they are. Yeah, the only section. In Orthodox Judaism, They have a law. Now, mind you, this is not Israeli law. This is Orthodox Judaism law. Israeli law throws this out the window. They say that we don't buy this. The Orthodox Judaism law is that you are Jewish if your mother was Jewish. That is Orthodox rules. This is not biblical law. This rule was invented about 300 years ago. 300 something years ago. I forgot the exact number. 300 plus years ago that the Orthodox law made this rule. Prior to that, it didn't matter if your mother or your father were. So in this, prior to 300 years ago, it was a dad, a father, or mother was acceptable, classified as being Jewish. It didn't make a difference. Now, this mother or father rule in Reform, they still obey this rule. They say, no, if your father was Jewish, you're Jewish, your mother, it makes a difference. But Orthodox Judaism, they only obey the mother rule. Israeli law includes grandparents, both sides. Grandmother or grandfather. Oops. What was that?
Nazi law.
Nazi law? Yeah, probably. So in modern-day Israel, they include grandparents on either side. Mother or father, they don't care. They go all the way back. If any one of them are Jewish, that's sufficient. You're Jewish. Orthodox didn't like these laws. I won't go into political reasons as to why, but it's a lengthy discussion and argument. So they created a new one about 300 and something years ago to isolate it down to mother only. So a lot of times, you may run across this in certain groups. They'll ask if your mom was Jewish or not. It's not always, but certain groups still ask that question. Yes, Pierre Ann. As far as modern day Judaism believes or conceives itself as all of the tribes of Israel. So they see that all one massive tribe, even though they call themselves Jewish, which means from Judah. But they use that term very loosely defined as being Israelite or Israeli. That's what they consider.
But even in Esther, mm-hmm. Mordecai is called a Jew.
Right.
He wasn't from the tribe of Jew.
Right, exactly.
So being Jewish doesn't mean that you came from
Judah. Correct. It doesn't mean you came from Judah, because he came from Benjamin. So the term itself is very, very loosely used, loosely defined. So you will have obviously all the various kings being Jewish or from Judah, from the tribe of Judah, obviously. Northern kings, whatever you also call them. I won't specify the definition of Jewish versus Israelite. I'm not going to discuss that today. There's lots of voluminous books written about that topic alone. So I want to talk about that. That's a little excessive for what I'm talking about. But I'll bring this out to us because in this instance, intertribal marriage. So intertribal marriage, your father dictated what tribe you were from, not your mom. Your father dictated it. If your mom was from an Egyptian and your dad was from the tribe of Judah, your inheritance, the tribe of Judah. You are from the tribe of Judah. Even though your mom was a Gentile, anything. Makes no difference. So I want to break that out to us that it's both sides are included in how the Torah is written. It doesn't care if your mother or your father. It includes both are Jewish. Now, your inheritance is based on your dad. So your inheritance might not be from a particular tribe if your dad is a Gentile. But whether you belong to the Israelite tribes, if either parent was, as far as the Torah is concerned, you belong. Made no difference. Does that make sense? I bring this up because we just talked about how you hook yourself onto a tribe by saying, I'm taking an oath to join it. So you can join a tribe biologically, or by oath makes no difference. And it doesn't matter which biology you joined in, whether it's father or your mother, it doesn't make a difference. The point is, when you join, you join. A lot of ways in, hoping few ways out. Orthodox does not use this rule. Orthodox only uses the mother rule alone. Can she be naturalized? She can convert. It is possible. I don't recall all the rules. I'm sorry, I didn't study that part. There are sequences of steps which you go through. My nephew wound up going through those steps in Israel a few months back. Go through the process, the steps to be classified as, now he could, if he chose to become an Israeli citizen, if he wanted to. But he didn't. He isn't. He lives in Portland. But he's going to college. But he went through the process, the steps of which they require. Now, it's not as prohibitive as one might think. Not requiring you to deny Messiah or anything like that. There's no requirements at all of that nature. So there's a lot of things which people can join up and hook onto a tribe, doesn't matter which one, very easily. It's really not that hard to do. DNA goes through female line too. DNA goes through all of them. That's okay.
It always does.
Yes, it always does. Yeah. Which is fine. Yeah, I don't know enough about DNA to know that those comments. Which were the fathers and mothers persists. So we have this inheritance rule. The inheritance does not go through from round to round, from tribe to tribe. So if you're a Gentile and you hook on to Gad's tribe or Issachar's tribe, or any other tribes you are, it doesn't switch around from tribal heritage. So you hook up the tribe, you're part of it, but if the inheritance already exists, it depends which family you joined in the tribe. Make sense? So if I have Manasseh broken up, let's say there's 500 families in the tribe of Manasseh, and I join one of those families. Well, whatever portion Manasseh was broken, let's say it was a small little dot here, was that 500th family, the one I joined. So any inheritance that may exist will only be with that little dot, not the rest of it. So there are some rules on how this process works, but that's how it's supposed to work. Any questions or comments?
How long did that last?
Inheritance last? Jubilee year.
No, how long did the historical last?
Oh, historical, I have no clue. I know that. Let's do it real quick. I know that David. There were a lot of strangers that hung out within side Israel, came visitors, that kind of thing. And David made sure that they understood they are foreigners. King David was pretty good at that. You do not belong unless you are biological, or marry in, or have that type. He made sure there was always a separation. He did pretty good at that. Let's see here. I'm going to jump to one topic. I'm going to end the next 5 minutes regarding this one subject matter. Yep. Deuteronomy 23. I'm sorry. Wrong chapter. Deuteronomy 7. Here's the other topic. Deuteronomy 7. There's something in here that should have made all of us cringe on our Torah portion. What was it? That could, but hopefully not. What would make you cringe? We just read. What happened to Midianites? Yeah. All the males killed, even the little baby boys. Right? The dads, the brothers, they're all dead. The baby boys, are they guilty? No. But they killed, yes. All the women, even if they didn't have kids, but they were married, they're dead too. Now that should, by our standards, say, ooh. Maybe it's cringe. You killed these people, right? Let's go through this a little bit. Let's Deuteronomy chapter 7. There are rules about how this process is supposed to work. Deuteronomy chapter 7, we read this regarding these are how captive women and captive wives and things like that are supposed to work here. When the Lord your God, chapter 7 of Deuteronomy, when the Lord your God gives you the land which you were to possess, and has cast out many nations before you, Hittite, the Girgashite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you, when Jehovah your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy upon them.
Nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter their son, nor take their daughter for your son. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of Jehovah will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. But thus you shall deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their sacred pillars, cut down their wooden images, burn up their carved images with fire. For you are a holy people to Jehovah your God. Your God has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure of all peoples of the face of the earth. Jehovah did not set his love on you, nor choose you because you are more number than other people, for you are the least of all peoples. Because Jehovah loves you, and because he would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers, Jehovah has brought you out with a mighty hand, redeemed you from the house of bondage, from the hand of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Therefore know Jehovah your God, he is God, faithful, and who keeps covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations with those who love him, keeps commandments, he repays those who hate him, their face, to destroy them, he will not be slack with him who hates him. He will repay him to his face. That you should keep the commandments and the statutes, the judgments which I command you to observe this day. So in this instruction, Deuteronomy 7, your sons aren't to marry the daughters of the Canaanites, right? Your daughters have to give their sons. Now, but you're in war, you just capture a bunch of girls because you killed everybody else off. They're, in this case, Midianites, which is not that much different than the Canaanite, as far as how their practices are. And what are the instructions when you capture a woman, a young girl, from a foreign tribe? Cut her hair. She is allowed to shave her head. Because mind you, the Torah instructions, when you're mourning, are you supposed to cut your hair when you're in mourning? No. No Israelites to do that. But what do the Canaanites do? When they're mourning, they cut their hair. That's what they do. Nothing wrong with that in their culture. God said you don't do that in Israelite culture. So what's he doing? In a moment of that 30-day period, she is allowed to mourn. So what does she do? She cuts her hair, as she would normally do. Burns her clothes, as she would normally do. Destroys the things showing signs of mourning for 30 days. But then you're allowed to marry her. We just read you're not supposed to give your daughters and your sons to the foreign women. What's up with that? Why is it that in this instance you can do so, but the Torah says you're not supposed to do so? Any ideas?
They have new owners.
New owners. You're a slave, essentially.
They're
all virgins. They haven't been known. But they have memories of their parents.
They're still very young.
They are still young. They are dependent on the husband. They are still very young.
And the culture.
So we just went through the process of how you attach yourself to a tribe, right? What method are these girls going to be attached to the tribe? They're going to be attached via marriage, right? That's the principle. They're going to be attached via through the process of marriage to these young men or however many men there are, I don't know. So in the process of attaching the marriage, they're going to marry. That's their attachment. Are they allowed to refuse? That's a good question. Do they wish to live? You see, you've been captured. You are a captive. You are a slave. If you tell your owner, I don't want this, I won't obey you, what happens to you? Your life just came to a quick end. So the girls are given the option. After 30 days, what's your choice? Now, I'm not saying the options are wonderful. The point is, these are your options. Because you're going to marry into this tribe, you're attached. If you say no, I'm not going to do it, you are choosing to die instead. That is your alternate option. Or you could theoretically be sold, but the point is you're choosing to be die instead. This marriage attachment, there are a lot of ways of attaching yourself to God's tribe, to God's world, God's people. And this is one of the methods through war. Now, mind you, this is not, we may think this is strange or barbaric, but reality is, that's what life is like, or was like, then, not so much now. Yes?
But didn't God say not to do that, especially with the captive female? She said, the Torah says, shave her hair, clip her nails,
let her mourn her parents.
Yeah, for 30 days, she shave, clip, and mourn her parents, right?
At that time, you know that the attraction to her is not physical, but spiritual. Then you let her go.
Right. If,
don't kill her, let her go.
That's if your attraction is that. If she's refusing to obey or follow the Israelite law, Israelite rules, then you can execute her. Now, mind you, all the Midianites were killed off. So there's no dad to go back to. There's no mother's household to go back to. They're all gone. You can send her off the wilderness and say, okay, go fend for yourself and hopefully you won't starve, but that's not a really good solution. So this is assuming she's choosing to follow. And over that 30-day period of time, hopefully you're doing a really good job trying to convince her. That's your job, hopefully. That's the process. Now, if you choose you don't like her anymore, she doesn't look right, or didn't think she's very pretty anymore, or you lost your attraction because you haven't used her, obviously that would be against the law, then you're allowing her to go free as opposed to executing her. But if you're not allowing her to go free, but she's refusing to follow God anyway, then she has the risk of dying. Not that you are forced to kill them, but it's possible you could kill them. She could be dying. Not that she's guaranteed, but it could happen. So the options are not really many for someone who's captured. There's a reason why captured people are not very well thought of. What's the risk if you do not wipe them out, their history out? You heard the book, Nehemiah talks about this. I don't remember the exact verse. When he says, I think it's Nehemiah, Ezra, one of those two. I think it's both of them. But they might both say it. That the Israelites came back and they had married foreign wives. Remember that? They married foreign wives that came back to captivity. What was their then new instruction? Get rid of them. Not kill them, but send them away. With their children. Oh, why would you do that? Because they are not attaching themselves to Israel. They are maintaining their foreign stance. Who teaches your children while you're out in the field working? The mom. Yeah, or disease. Yeah, they're gone. Your mom's doing it. You're busy working. You're providing for your family. So what type of children are you going to have?
Rotten.
Rotten. Children who are pagans like the moms are. So you would have terrorists. Okay, let's not go too far in this. The point is, the attachment is an important thing. How you attach yourself, both on the dad's side and the mom's side, matters. The method of attachment is important. Hence, the idea of you have a captive wife, be very, very careful and weary of a captive wife. Is she attaching herself? Is she not? Is she willing? We had the term in Christianity, we use the term unequally yoked people. It's the same thing. You have one that is following, one is not. Be very weary, wary of that attachment, of that process. It's dangerous to you and to your children. Does that make sense? Hopefully it does. It's the same principle being taught here and in here in the Torah. That unequally yoked section, that somebody who's not truly dedicated, it's an important process to remember. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Don.
Not only is it very dangerous, we are living through that same
experience. Our whole world? You have your personal family. okay. You're living through it.
College,
Yep, married to the wives. Yep.
Married, loved them very deeply.
Oh yeah, I'm sure you do love them.
And we enjoy the company, a lot of fun. But we know that their children supersede
ours. Yep. Yep.
Trying really hard
to work in there. Yep. Yeah, so he's pointing out his personal family. He has sons. They married daughters who were not, or women who were not Christian or philosophy that way, and it affects the children. How many of you have had children who? Well, I haven't had any yet. That are not that age. Who have married off into other cultures or other belief systems? It does happen. It does. And how does it affect things? It affects those grandchildren, your grandchildren. It affects them as they grow. It turns them into what God didn't want. Now, if you don't love them, it's not about love, but what God is desiring for you and for the culture. Any other questions or comments?
Can we stop now?
Yes, we're stopping. What was that?
Who's your grandfather?
Well, that's true. Let's go and end with a prayer. Almighty God, our good Father, thank you for the Shabbat day of rest. Father, thank you for teaching us and helping us to grow. Please bless us as we learn your ways to share with one another the things you've taught us. That we all learn and be stronger people, good servants to you. Help us to serve one another, to fill in what must be done, Father. For you are kind, that we attached ourselves to you, and you have attached yourself to us. We ask these blessings the rest of our Shabbat, Father, in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.